They send our children to Syria. They have created delivery networks. I apologize to you. We have so far prevented 6,000 people from taking a trip and have destroyed the networks. But we were surprised to be accused of being anti-jihad. We were surprised that human rights organizations complained that we were preventing the transporting of these people. Let me tell you why we do it. Our young men are deployed on the front lines and are taught how to kidnap, steal, and raid villages. Our children are at the peak of their youth. I apologize to you for uttering these words. Our daughters are there to perform coitus for hundreds and thousands of times. And when they bear the fruits of these sexual acts in their wombs, they are sent back to us. All this is done under the pretext of the so-called marriage jihad, while we are just watching them. This is just a small part of the issue. We have arrested 86 people who have been sent there. The last one was arrested 2 days ago. This is apart from the 6,000 young people that we have saved. They are helpless sisters, widows, mothers of lost boys and girls who come to us at the Interior Ministry and stage a sit-in.
My name is Ines, and I have been to Syria from January 2013 till June the same year.
Tunisia, where the Islamic awakening first arose, is a world away from extremism of any kind. Yet, there are wild rumors flying around that more than 6,000 Tunisians are in Syria and Iraq, fighting shoulder to shoulder with Takfiri militants. The rumors also have it that among the Tunisian comrades in arms, there are a bevy of girls and young women, an issue that has caused many raised eyebrows. At the Islamic Association of Dar al-Hadith, Sheikh Farid al-Beji is refuting Takfirism, an unorthodox belief that classifies all non-practicing Muslims as kafirs or infidels.
Any Muslim, no matter however many cardinal sins he commits, would never be an infidel. However, he would be considered a sinful servant who has done wrong, but he is yet a Muslim, as it is written in the book Sahih al-Bukhari. Religious speeches in Tunisia, particularly after the revolution, have been plagued by some sort of tension which has resulted from the public disorder and lawlessness that came with the revolution. Not to forget that Wahhabis have entered and traveled across the country. Many of their speakers and recruiters took over the pulpits of mosques and some other media. Unfortunately, at the beginning of their political activities, they gained this coverage that enabled them to build these instigating communities to recruit and send our youth, both girls and boys, to the war in Syria. They left to fight in Syria. Due to the chaotic security situation at the borders, they first entered Libya and then entered Syria via Turkey. The sad part is that our intelligence studies, which I personally follow, show the participation of our very young girls in this matter. Most of them set off on this path accompanied by their brothers or husbands. The majority of them are not alone on this path. The number of young women who were by themselves was very small. They go there with only one intention in mind: to get married legally and lawfully. But when heavy fighting takes place and lives are lost, they don't let women stay widows. They don't even let them pass their Edda period before remarrying them to another fighter. Therefore, they don't even observe religious rules and regulations and have changed them according to their whims. They would tell our girls that their participation in such marriages is an honor for them and that it is a great opportunity for them to get married to Takfiri militants. They were told that this way they could participate in Syria's fighting. They addressed both young men and women as their audience, since in this matter, they claim to have faith in equality of the sexes. They distort fatwas and religious orders according to their interests. As we have repeatedly put it, and I reiterate it here again, the Arab world and Syrian nation are paying a hefty price. Also, such massacres and infighting would make us forget the main issue, which is the matter of Palestine.
Taysir is living in a suburb of Tunis, the capital city of Tunisia. Having a poor understanding of Islam, she fell for a male classmate at university, who manipulated her into going with him to Syria.
I was a sophomore student in literature when the revolution took place in Tunisia in 2011. Many things changed in my country because of the revolution. One was religion and the other one was political standings. Many of the social, political, and religious structures changed, and as a result, people got influenced by the changes as well. One of the table-turning changes was that concerns over hijab were eased, and everyone picked up their own Islamic coverage according to their tastes. Many young girls started wearing hijab without being afraid of persecution or harassment. At that time, I got closer to some of my classmates who had religious views and were observing hijab. Little by little, I asked them questions about the things I was excited to know more about. Gradually, I learned different things and found them thrilling. I finally chose hijab.
University of Tunis, Faculty of Human and Social Sciences. The campus is crowded with angry students protesting against a new decision that bans female students with a niqab from taking part in final examinations. While the faculty claims that the new decision is to prevent imposters from the exams, the students regard the decision as religious discrimination against Muslim students. The atmosphere is charged with tension. Among the crowd, a group of extremists are fishing in troubled waters. They are trying to win the trust of the girls and push them little by little into a trap that might ruin their lives forever, into what is known better as the so-called Jihad al-Nikah, or sexual jihad.
At that time, when the problems of the country were getting more serious, such issues infiltrated our university as well. There were many strikes, sit-ins, and events organized by students. Part of the protests was in response to two of our girl students being denied entry to sit for the exams because they were wearing niqabs. They demanded them to reveal their faces. The strikes were organized by students, but some religious and pious people also joined them from outside of the university. They believed that these ladies were quite as well entitled to participate in the classes and sit for the exams. During the strikes, I got much closer to pious people and established strong rapport with them. We got closer to each other and held religious classes on religious principles, Sharia, the Holy Quran, and the Sunnah. This way, we quenched our thirst for Islamic knowledge. After a while, I met one of my classmates who would usually teach us religious studies. He was seemingly pious, modern intellectual, who was aware of the politics and social issues and enjoyed a high standard of civilities. He would constantly teach us new things and would provide us with easy books and passages so that we could broaden the horizon of our religious knowledge. That was particularly useful for me, who even after donning hijab, still didn't have a comprehensive grasp on religion.
The Islamic awakening in Tunisia had fired young people's enthusiasm for Islam. But the downside was that some extremist groups could recruit their forces all in the name of pure religion.
The most important hadith that we would hear at those times were the ones by the Prophet, peace be upon him. There is this one in which he says that my nation divides into 70 sects of whom all but one will enter the fire. I used to think that we were that one righteous sect because we were the only sect who had followed the right successor and thus was the only one immune from the fire of hell.
The fiery rhetoric of Wahhabism appealed to a wide audience, most of them with little or no knowledge of Islam and Islamic teachings. The speeches aimed mainly to brainwash young people.
Today, I know the true meaning of Wahhabism and Salafism. At that time, we were under the illusion that we were right and that we would all go to heaven and that all those who opposed us were infidels and simply did not follow Islam. My relations with that classmate continued and we kept exchanging books and knowledge. And when the opportunity presented itself, he proposed to me. I informed my family, but they were totally against it. I had changed. I was aggressive. I could no longer care about my studies. I could feel that he was even more anxious than me. I quit studying and removed myself from my social surroundings. But my family remained adamant and disapproved of the young guy. When I told him that my family would not approve of our marriage, he suggested that we get married without their permission, but otherwise Sharia-bound, and also that we didn't have to register our marriage. I accepted it. They persuaded me that this type of marriage was religiously lawful. The things that I planned to do after the marriage and the goals that I was pursuing encouraged me to agree to such a union. My spouse and I could leave for the so-called jihad in Syria. This was my main stimulant and encouragement since it was of great interest to me, and for months I had been studying and watching videos, CDs and websites on how to fight.
To encourage more and more people to join them in Iraq and Syria, the extremist groups didn't confine themselves to speeches. They've been uploading countless promotional videos about their terrorist activities, all under the cloak of Islam and jihad. To justify their heinous crimes, they offer an unorthodox interpretation of Islamic texts in a way that suits their inhumane actions.
When the Wahhabi movement gained momentum in Tunisia, they managed to tap into the youth's religious sentiments, since on the one hand, their emotions were running very high. But on the other hand, they didn't have the knowledge and perception to immunize their sentiments against homicidal Wahhabi teachings of murder and war. The Wahhabis made use of some authentic hadith, such as the one that says at the end of time, there would happen many battles and great wars in the land of Levant, which is Damascus today. Authentic as these hadith might be, but the scholars agree that such wars would happen at the end of time and right before the judgment day, and definitely not at this period of time. The Wahhabi leaders abused such hadith and told our youth that if you go to war now, you would make the majority of the martyrs, and on the day of judgment, you will enter heaven along alongside prophets and saints.
For a while after his disappearance, no one had any information about him. Then we heard that police had arrested him somewhere in the governorate of Kisserine. People would say that he got arrested in Shambi Mountains, where he was aiding the Takfiri militants. After this, I somehow returned to the warmth of my family. They were the closest people to me. I continued my religious studies and got to know about more aspects of my religion. My family also encouraged me to learn more about the things I was unaware of.
In the end, Taysir's parents introduced their daughter to Islamic scholars, who helped her have a better understanding of Islam. On the other hand, Armini was deprived of such a chance because her family were not aware of what was going on. Now her fate is veiled in mystery.
Once, members of a charity foundation came here and said that they were willing to instruct girls in beneficial crafts. I told my sister, Armini, that I wanted to end this joblessness and learn something useful. The teacher of the foundation was Lebanese.
A female Lebanese teacher had come here. She wanted to teach girls beneficial things. They had told everyone to ask their sisters and relatives to join them in the classes. My sisters informed me and I thought it was a good idea. It was, of course, better than sitting at home doing nothing and whining, so I gave them the permission.
So this seemed to be a good idea at first. She would get out of the house and she started working with them. Gradually, her behavior changed. She wasn't the same even with me. We weren't talking like before either. She had changed a lot.
She changed the way she dressed and changed her hijab. She was not like before, although she used to observe hijab, but now she had added the niqab to it. I was surprised and decided to talk to her. She talked to me of religion and various aspects of it. She talked to me about things of which I had no complete knowledge of, things she was not willing to discuss with anyone else. I didn't try to limit her, but talked to a religious scholar about her. After a while, the sheikh told me that he had seen my sister in a religious gathering attended by many who hold different views from ours.
After a while, she started asking us not to watch TV. She would say that watching it is forbidden. She was no longer interested in sitting down and having a chat with me. She was unwilling to talk to anyone in the family. Whenever a guest came over, she would cover her face from him. She was totally uninterested in chatting to anyone or talking in general.
I felt like they had kidnapped a girl from amongst us. Everyone we knew would ask after her. Neighbors could no longer see her, and she had no intention to socialize with them anymore. Sometimes, some people would come to me and would say, "Man, be careful. Your sister is mingling with the wrong crowd and questionable individuals."
She would bring me CDs. From where I don't know. Did they give her these CDs, or did she obtain them by herself? I don't know. The CDs were on the subject of jihad. She would say that a woman should participate in jihad. Sometimes she would talk about Afghanistan, Somalia, and jihad.
Well, in fact, I should say I stood up against her and told her that this had to stop. I forbade her to leave the house, but the result was that after a few days, we could no longer find the girl.
In June 2013, Armini left the house and never returned again. We didn't find her. After an anxious period of not having any news and not finding any trace, we finally received this text from her, saying that she was in Turkey and getting ready to join the so-called jihad in Syria.
I could never ever believe that my little sister would one day do such a thing. She was raised in the warmth of a big family. We were both raised with the same standards and the same culture, but we didn't know her. We could no longer recognize our little sister. She was like a daughter to me. She would never do anything without telling me, even the smallest things like leaving the house. She would let me know. But suddenly, we're utterly surprised by her travel to a foreign country. This is just beyond me.
To collect some information about my sister, I talked to some people who had returned from Syria. I heard about Ines, who was injured and hospitalized. I went to visit her in the hospital. She was in a pathetic condition.
She came to visit me at the hospital. She came to collect some information about her sister, who just like me, had set off for the so-called jihad in Syria, but no one had any news of her up until then.
Ines, a Tunisian woman, was living a normal life when her husband converted to Wahhabism. Then, along with her husband, she was forced to go to Syria, where after a while she had to sleep with many men in the name of the so-called sexual jihad. Now, Ines is home with a baby in her belly, without knowing who the father of her child is. She tells us about her harrowing experiences.
We got on the car and traveled all the way as far as the border between Tunisia and Libya. At the border, we met with some other guys. I realized that my husband knew them very well. We accompanied them. In Tunisia, things were normal because I knew the guys who were there. They were from the same community that I attended. But then, there were these new guys. At the Libyan borders, we got into SUVs with some new guys. They got in first, and then I hopped in. I was almost unable to see anything. We followed the borders all the way up till Benghazi port. We stopped on that route for 2 or 3 times and not more. Each time we would rest for a little and then resume our travel. At each stop, we would be met by some guys who were waiting for us. They would welcome us. In Libya, I felt neither worries nor any pressures that came with a warring situation. It could be because of the fact that I was placed at the very back of the car and I had no understanding of what went on outside. The other reason was that each of our stops was at a perfectly chosen locale where things were calm and peaceful. People would welcome us with open arms and smiling faces. There was no problem and I could feel nothing wrong at that place and that time. When we arrived in Benghazi, I was met with another situation. People whom I knew back in Tunisia were now completely changed. I was now faced with a fully armed regiment, a full regiment who were waiting for only 2 women. What was even more painful for me was the fact that my husband knew almost each and every one of them. In those moments, my mind was incapable of analyzing that this was a full and complete network. I was terrified.
I was even scared of my husband. My faith had been in God and in my husband, but now I was afraid of him, since I could not believe that he had relations with Takfiri militants. We were in Benghazi merely for 48 hours or less, and then we were taken to the airport to send us to Turkey. The only thing that I would like to remember from after leaving Tunisia and before entering Syria is the time that I spent in Istanbul. Because there I was quite like an ordinary woman, a newlywed who was taken to a foreign trip, an expedition by her husband. This was in addition to the fact that I had never left Tunisia before. It was only me and my husband and the exploration of a foreign country. In fact, it was not real. But I was under such an illusion. I had no idea of what was lying in wait for me. While waiting in Turkey, my husband met with a man named Abu Ghazi. He met with him again and again, and each time I did not accompany him. They would talk and I had no idea about what. Of the 48 hours we waited in Turkey, only 3 were spent exploring the city. And those 3 hours are to this day the most memorable hours of my life. I would relive these hours the most when I was in Syria. Whenever I got exhausted and irritated, I would reminisce about those moments and fantasize about experiencing them again. The last time I met Abu Ghazi was the last time I saw Istanbul. That meeting was close to the borders. I would say close because I did not have clear information. They would lead me and I would follow. Abu Ghazi was leading a group of different nationalities who were all heading to Syria. They brought a small truck and we all got on. Men from the front and women from the back. I can say that this was the last time I saw Istanbul and the sun before reaching Syria. They took us to a camp which was set up in an old and abandoned hospital. This place was for the militants and their wives. The place was like a township and women were divided into groups, but I had no information of the regimentation and accommodation of the men. We had to wake up at dawn and prepare very large quantities of food and wash tons of clothes. There was a huge number of men whom we had to satisfy. At least we had to satisfy their hunger for food. The only thing that would make all this tolerable was the fact that we believed that we were the most honorable women on earth and the closest to heaven. I kept on living there, and because of the sort of life that I had in the camp and the relationships that I had made with other women there, I gradually discovered that many of the women there who had lost their husbands were remarried to other militants. I talked to one of them who had this happen to her. She told me that the militants would go from one place to another. They would go from Idlib to Damascus to Qusair, and they don't take their spouses with themselves because they'd be a burden. The men had to fight and couldn't take care of their wives. Then, in that moment, I realized that upon their deployment to another front, the militants would divorce their wives and would marry new women in their new place of deployment. And this wouldn't happen just for once. Oh my God. After a while, my husband came to me and said that he was going to fight in the Al-Qusair front. My heart dropped. I was hoping that he wouldn't divorce me. I was hoping that I was different from the others. Thankfully, he did not divorce me. He set off for the fronts. The women didn't leave me on my own and helped me through it all, thanks to God. But after a month, he came back, and he came back with only one intention. He divorced me and left, and I never heard of him again.
Some of the Takfiri leaders exploit the weakness and loneliness of foreign girls and draw them into an endless whirlpool of marriages, which are unlawful according to Islamic marriage rules. Some of them are married 10 times in this unlawful way.
After only 2 days of my divorce, one of the commanders came to me and asked me to marry him. Only after 2 days after my divorce. Of course I rejected his offer, because, oh my God, we are ordered in our Sharia that women should refrain from marriage and sexual activities for a certain period of time after divorce or the death of their husband. I told him this, but in fact, he had a premeditated answer. I said that such a thing was illogical and impossible. Nevertheless, all the women at the camp encouraged me to agree to such a marriage and said that it was wrong for me to stay single. After 2 days, the new guy told me that he had to leave Idlib to go and fight in another front. And, oh God, he divorced me after a 2-day marriage. After the passage of a few days after my second divorce, I noticed that my second husband had not left Idlib. Through the women and their husbands, I realized that he was still in Idlib. It was then that for the very first time I got truly scared, because my trust was taken away from me. I could no longer trust the people around me. I realized that I was completely alone. They were the absolute rulers of everything. Besides, I was merely a foreigner in that war camp. They would control all the aid routes and even the citizens, let alone the militants. Everything was under their absolute power and control. I could see no solution in front of me. How and from where could I leave? I did not even have a vehicle to leave. I had gone under a roof from which there was no escape. In fact, I could see myself stuck in a whirlpool. I had no other options but to give in to the situation. Each week, we would face 5 husbands. Not everyone was the same, but almost all of them were foreigners. But on the average, 5 marriages a week. At first, they would explain to me the reasons for divorce and would try to justify it. But after a while, when they saw that I had given up, they would no longer even bother to explain. The more they could see that I had realized the gravity of my situation and thus disillusioned, the more they would get me involved and the more they would abuse me and put me under pressure. Then came a time when they started to see me as a burden, and it was when I got pregnant. Then they told me that I could leave if I wanted to. They picked me up in a car with the militants and then abandoned me 1 kilometer to borders. I walked that 1 kilometer to the border, and there I was met by the Turkish border patrol. They sent me to Istanbul, to the Tunisian embassy, and then I was sent back to Tunisia. Meanwhile, I was interrogated thoroughly by everyone, be it from the border police to the embassy staff and so on. What have you done? Where have you been? How? And so forth. Then, when I arrived in Tunisia, I got arrested, and here I was once more interrogated extensively. Upon realizing that I was pregnant, I was sent to hospital for medical exams.
In the hospital, Ines found out that she was infected with AIDS, but fortunately, her baby boy was not.
The poor girl was so frail and could not even talk. We went to visit her many times. We tried to get her out of there. We tried to change her mood or at least help her. I am a simple super at an apartment building, so I am of few means and did not have much money to help her. So I tried to help her through the people I knew. I tried to find her a job. Her sister would take her out. The battles and the things she had witnessed had taken a huge toll on her. We would feel that she was like a small child in need of help, a child whose hands you had to take to walk, and you had to help for even the smallest tasks and raising her kid.
I helped her settle down in a small house with her child, a house within her means. Every once in a while we would get out of the house and chat. She was slightly getting better and she would now talk a little. Today, I felt that Ines is a human being again and that she's capable of talking and conversing with others one more time. She can now stand on her own feet. Thanks to God, she is back to life.
Yusra helped me find a house to live in.
After her discharge from the hospital, she stayed with us for a while until we managed to get her a house and a job to look after herself. We would leave every morning together and would come back in the evening together. I could not leave her on her own. She was really scared.
Yusra's family helped me find a job. A lonely mother with a sick child to look after. A sick child who doesn't even have birth certificate. I work as a housekeeper in house. When I look at myself, I wonder where I was and where I am now. A university student who was waiting for a bright future back then. And now a lonely mother of a sick child who has to work in people's houses. No family, no support. It's not only my problem. The problem exists in the world around me.
We
We said before that what has come to be known as the so-called jihad marriage is religiously and legally forbidden and unlawful. It is so wrong for a woman to have intercourse with 10 men in 4 months, and it is in fact fornication and forbidden. Oh, God forbid. The government was really disorganized at that time. Therefore, we witnessed that some members of the parliament, who happened to be of the ruling party, used to encourage people to go and fight in Syria. The head of the ruling party, enjoying the support of different parties and committees, supported the sending of our people there. And when there were public announcements for people to join the so-called jihad in Syria, these leaders actually oversaw such calls. Worst of all was the fact that the Minister of Religious Affairs, Nur el-Din Khademi, used to emphasize on the so-called jihad against Syria and encourage people for it. But after the recent developments and the disclosure of the facts, they realized that they were involved in an idiotic political game and gradually retreated from their positions. At first, we were few and weak, and we would get threatened whenever we raised our voices. I was provided protection and bodyguards by the Interior Ministry. But now they see that the frail voice of me that tried to steer them away from these crowds at the onset of the revolution is now a very loud and vociferous voice.
Some Muslims fail to differentiate between Takfiri's unorthodox interpretation of Islam, which is a world away from true Islamic teachings that preach love and mercy. They are most likely to find themselves in a merciless trap, just like those Tunisian girls did.
She began to think of us as godless people. Us, her sister and brother and parents and family, got close to people whom she thought to be closer to God. They had brainwashed her with these ideas. Gradually, we could see that we no longer knew our girl and she didn't know us in return. Thus, she left us and went away.
I want to tell those who have inflicted this misery upon my sister, Ines, and girls like her that this is not jihad and this is not Islam, that you are destroying lands and their people.
We have always said and will say again, and as you can see, many of the religious leaders who used to support the war on Syria have now retracted their words. The war and the massacre in Syria comes with a hefty price tag, since it is nothing but a war and fighting that would make us forget the most important issue, which is the matter of Palestine's occupation. Now they see that we were right to try to prevent people from joining the so-called jihad in Syria. As you can see now, those who claim to be the flag bearers of this so-called jihad, that is ISIL, Al-Nusra Front, and the likes, are now killing and beheading one another. Of course, because these are people who have no correct understanding of religion, knowledge, and sciences. They have no righteous faith to be the man of jihad for God. Killing and massacring in Islamic lands is never jihad for God.
Today, I have become a tolerant and patient person, and I thank God for the patience that He has bestowed upon His servants. Having faith in God would keep you from forgetting and forgoing everything and all that there is. I would say now that I have no hatred of anything. I don't hate the niqab or the religion, God forbid, never. I might hold hatred towards some people, but definitely not towards God and His servants. I only hate the people and the situations that inflicted such a pain upon me and forced me and my child to be in such a misery. If it had not been for the grace of God and that pious servant of His, I might have never left that awful place and have not returned to my country and would have had an unknown future. Anyhow, I wish they could know the God I know and had real faith in Him, so that then they would possibly refrain from doing such horror to me and people like me.
I don't know what to do with you.